Our next speaker is Dr. Suresh Agarwal, who comes to us from Duke University, and he's going to be talking about aspects of the use of plasma in these patients. Suresh?
So, well, actually, I'm going to be talking a little bit about some adjuncts to the massive transfusion protocol, particularly the use of thromboelastography. And I'd like to thank the American College of Surgeons as well as Dr. Schreiber for the privilege of presenting. First of all, I do have one disclosure to make. I have intellectual property concerning relationship with acute innovations that has absolutely nothing to do with the talk today. So, unfortunately, it has not led to any remuneration either. So, since the turn of the millennium, we have had rapidly adopted the practices of damage control resuscitation, as outlined by lessons learned in the combat arena by Dr. Spinella and colleagues, and their classic retrospective study, which shows coagulopathy independent of hyperthermia, but strongly associated with acidosis and injury severity, was associated with mortality in combat casualties. Rapid control of bleeding, preventing hypothermia and acidosis, allowing graded hypotension, avoiding crystalloids, and relying upon blood and blood products markedly improved survival. Over the past 5 years, we've had the opportunity to witness the publication of two major studies on transfusion. The first, the Prospective Observational Multicenter Major Trauma Transfusion Study, better known as the PROMPT trial, was a prospective cohort study of approximately 900 trauma patients receiving large volume transfusion. It examined the timing of product administration as well as the ratio of administered plasma to red blood cells and platelets to red blood cells, with a primary outcome of in-hospital mortality. Results of the multivariable Cox regression models demonstrated the transfusion of balanced ratios of at least 1:2 for plasma and 1:1 for platelets within the first 6 hours of care was associated with lower in-hospital mortality. This association did not persist beyond 6 hours, with the theory that mortality due to ongoing bleeding becomes overshadowed by mortality due to TBI. The result of the PROMPT study led to a randomized clinical trial of 1 unit packed red blood cells to 1 unit of fresh frozen plasma to 1 unit of platelets versus 1:1:2, known as the pragmatic optimal plasma and platelet ratio or proper trial. This study recruited approximately 700 adult trauma patients to be randomized to receive these ratios and studied 24-hour and 30-day mortality as the primary outcomes. While the trial did not demonstrate a significant mortality difference between the two groups, patients in the 1:1:1 group achieved significantly higher rates of hemostasis, as judged by the surgeons, as well as experienced fewer deaths due to exsanguination compared to the 1:1:2 group. Although we rapidly adopted the concept of 1:1:1 transfusion for traumatic hemorrhage, the concept of one size fits all may not be the best strategy. Similarly, although wearing David Seed's jacket and Tommy Boy gives great Chris Farley great joy, the end result may not be exactly what he desired. In other words, a one size fits all strategy may not be the best technique. So, should the resuscitation of hemorrhagic shock be the same for all patients, or are we able to tailor it to address the individual physiologic changes that each patient experiences? I would argue that the answer is maybe. Perhaps we can better assess clot initiation, but as of yet, we have been unable to adequately predict glycocalyx resilience. And as you can see, the glycocalyx is actually fairly important, as demonstrated by Dr. Kozar's very impressive work. After After all, as we move towards an era of more precision medicine, have we not utilized lactate, base deficit, and echocardiography to better define endpoints of resuscitation in a variety of shock states? Upon reflection, our original massive transfusion protocol, which was, as stated in the protocol, designed to provide a trauma patient with defined blood products dependent upon an algorithmic response to hemorrhagic shock. Once activated, with a call to the transfusion services, three deliveries or rounds were prepared for the patient as follows. This was our initial approach, and our first round was 4 units of packed red blood cells and 4 units of fresh frozen plasma. Our second round was 8 units of packed red blood cells, 8 units of FFP, 1 unit of platelets, and 1 unit of cryo. And our third round went back to a protocol of 8 units of platelets, 8 units of FFP and 8 units of packed red blood cells. From the original protocol came an EPIC generated an integrated protocol, which you see here. Although initially more complex in appearance, it clearly states our goal of achieving 1-to-1-to-1 ratios in both massive transfusion platelets and obstetrically bleeding patients. Order sets and laboratory guidance with emergency consultation contact information was provided to enhance communication between the frontline providers and our blood bank. Furthermore, the first role of laboratory assessment is added to the protocol to help guide utilization of blood products. And this demonstrates that it's clear that we're emphasizing 1-to-1-to-1 ratio. But the other thing that we did is we started using laboratory values. So once providers had initiated the protocol and begun resuscitation, the second half of this protocol would guide them through targeting patient-specific needs regarding anemia, thrombocytopenia, hypofibrinogenemia, and deviations on newer diagnostics such as Rotem. In addition, the protocol incorporated the potential to administer TXA and advise on when to deploy more specialized assets such as factor concentrates, PCCs, or recombinant agents. In all, this new protocol represented a huge step forward in the care of the bleeding patient at our institution with improved collaboration and defined goals, regardless of team or location. I'm just going to go over thromboelastography and Rotem for a few seconds. So TEG is a test that was developed at the University of Heidelberg by Dr. Hartert in Germany in 1948, and it was used to better characterize clotting function and blood elastic properties than laboratory tests that were available at that time. At that time, it was PTT and PT, as well as a bleeding time. The test sample is placed in the oscillating cup at 37 degrees Celsius. A pin is suspended into the sample from the torsion wire. Development of fibrin strands couple the motion of the cup to the pin. The coupling is directly proportional to clot strength. Increased tension in the wire is detected by the electromagnetic transducer, and the electrical signal amplified creates a trace which is displayed upon a computer or printed out. Deflection of the trace is proportional to clot strength. So this is a typical trace, and here you can see several values. The R value, or the reaction times, is the time of latency from start of the test to initial fibrin formation with an amplitude of about 2 millimeters. K is the time taken to achieve a certain clot strength, usually about 20, an amplitude of 20 millimeters. Alpha is the angle between R and K, which measures the speed at which fibrin buildup and cross-linking is taking place. And then you can also measure the maximal clot strength and time to maximal clot strength, and as well as lysis parameters. We can use the R values, the K value, and the MA value to identify characteristics consistent with a variety of coagulopathies and see the response to the therapy and treat accordingly. We can also use it to test our therapeutic interventions. The top plot represents a normal TEG curve. However, if we see One of the other plots, we can give plasma, platelets, cryoprecipitate, or TXA as needed. And just similarly, an oversimplified algorithm has us using FFP for an increased R time, cryoprecipitate for a decreased alpha angle, platelets for a decreased clot strength, or MA, and transoxemic acid for the fibrinolysis pattern. We can also use it for hypercoagulable traits and for predicting when we should be giving heparin and other products to prevent ischemic events. Rotational thromboelastometry is an extension of TEG, which was developed in the United States. It's very similar to TEG, but has some important differences. Blood, about 300 microliters, is anticoagulated with citrate and placed in a disposable cuvette using an electronic pipette. And there is a disposable pin which is connected with the spring, and this is equivalent to the torsion wire. And this spring oscillates back and forth slowly. The test is started by adding reagents. The instrument measures and graphically displays the changes in elasticity at all stages. Usually it's at 37 degrees, but it can mimic patients who are hypothermic or hyperthermic by changing the temperature as well. And one of the most important things is it's not as sensitive to bumps that you may experience with the TEG, so it's a much more reliable measurement, also more expensive. So the clot is actually, the tracing is actually very similar to that of a TEG, but not exactly the same. And there are certain things that are actually very useful in determining the clot strength and the need for products in a rotum that you would not see with a TEG analysis. So this is a comparison of the two plots. They're actually very similar in appearance. However, with a rotum, you can use the A5, 10, 15, and 20 values to look at the amplitude and the rate of change in the amplitude to determine expected maximal clot formation at a much earlier time than with rotum. Here's something I found online that makes it even easier. This is from Life in the Fast Lane. So that the plots are actually very, the plots are very similar, and you can use my fondness for drinking alcohol as a measure for how to assess what products are needed. So if you see a brandy tumbler, that's what a normal tracing looks like, or you can, it's also a tracing you'd see with a hypercoagulable state. If you see a red wine glass-like tracing, it would be useful to give FFP. If you see a test tube-like tracing, which has a very low maximal clot strength, it's useful to give platelets. If you see a champagne flute tracing, cryoprecipitate is useful. And an upside-down martini glass is someone who is fibrinolytic and would benefit from TXA. So this is just a reminder of what our order set looked like. And so what we did is we took a look at our order set. And this axis is not intuitive. RBCs are on the right axis and have their own axis because the numbers are much higher than other products. Everything else is on the left-hand axis. XTEM values and cryo percent, when we started in November of 2017, XTEM values and cryo precipitate usage rose 15 and 17% respectively. In addition, our use of platelets rose about 20%. So this is another plot which demonstrates that when we started using it, and our ability to get, with the use of ROTEM in our protocol, we're able to get to a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio more accurately in our populations. I wish I could say that we were the first to do this. This, what I'm providing is preliminary data from Dr. Vatsas and Dr. Tracy at our institution. However, it's actually being used at lots of other places. This is a pre-published ahead of print from the Journal of Trauma, and this is a data-driven algorithm that was in Annals of Surgery in August of this year. So overall, you know, I think we're at a stage where we can do a little bit better with precision medicine in terms of coagulation. However, I don't think we're 100% there yet. We have no way of looking at the endothelial glycocalyx, and we have protocols which address component therapy, and those decrease overall use and assist with more rapid clot formation. But I think we're really in our infancy, and I think there's much more to come. Thank you very much.
Questions for Dr. Agarwal? Suresh, you know, people in the audience may or may not have a TEG or a ROTEM. If they don't, which one do you recommend they get?
Yeah, I think it depends on resources, and it's much simpler to have a and more stable to use a ROTEM, but it's also much more expensive. The TEG systems are although they're produced a long time ago, are much less expensive for the machine and actually running the test.
So it takes a while to get a result from either one. You got a massively bleeding patient, they're coagulopathic. By the time you get the result, you know, some would argue that their coagulopathy has changed and the results are no longer useful. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely correct. There are some benefits of using a ROTEM where you can use some of the A values at 5, 10, and 15 minutes to predict how fast clot formation is actually occurring. However, 5, 10, 15 minutes is still too long. I think over time we'll have a better idea of how to assess both clot formation and clot interaction with the vascular endothelium.
How many in the room either use TEG or ROTEM for massive transfusions? Oh, maybe about half or just less than half. Very good. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. You want to introduce?